13. The show. 1. Someday, if your life is long and your thinking machinery stays in gear, you'll live to remember the last good thing that ever happened to you. That's not pessimism talking, just logic. I hope I haven't run out of good things yet. There would be no purpose in living if I believed I had. But it's been a long time between. I remember the last one, clearly. It happened a little over 4 years ago, on the evening of April 15th, at the Scotto Gallery. It was between 7:45 and 8 o'clock, and the shadows on Palm Avenue were beginning to take on the first faint tinges of blue. I know the time because I kept checking my watch. The Scotto was already packed, to the legal limit and probably a little beyond, but my family hadn't arrived. I'd seen Pam and Illy earlier in the day, and Wireman had assured me that Melinda's flight was on time. But so far that evening, there hadn't been a sign of them. Or a call. In the alcove to my left, where both the bar and 8 of the Sunset With pictures had drawn a crowd, a trio from the local music conservatory was tinkling through a funereal version of My Funny Valentine. Mary Iyer, holding a glass of champagne but sober so far, was expatiating on something artistic to an attentive little crowd. To the right was a bigger room featuring a buffet. On one wall in there was Roses Grow from Shells and a painting called I See the Moon. On another, 3 views of Duma Road. I'd observed several people taking photographs of these with their camera phones, although a sign on a tripod just inside the door announced that all photography was verboten. I mentioned this to Jimmy Yoshida in passing, and he nodded, seeming not angry or even irritated, but rather bemused. There are a great many people here I either don't associate with the art scene or don't recognize at all, he said. The size of this crowd is outside my experience. Is that a bad thing? God, no. But after years of fighting to keep our corporate heads above water, it feels strange to be carried along this way. The Scotto Center Gallery was large, which was a good thing that night. In spite of the food, drink, and music in the smaller rooms, the center seemed to be where most of the visitors eventually gravitated. The Girl and Ship series had been mounted there on almost invisible cords, directly down the center of the room. Wireman Looks West was on the wall at the far end. That one and Girl and Ship number 8 were the only paintings in the show which I had stickered NFS, Wireman because the painting was his, and number 8 because I simply couldn't sell it. We keeping you up, boss? Angel Slobotnik said from my left, as oblivious to his wife's elbow as ever. No, I said. I was never more awake in my life. I just... A man in a suit that had to have cost 2 grand stuck out his hand. Henry Vestic, Mr. Fremantle, First Sarasota Bank and Trust, private accounts. These are just marvelous. I'm stunned. I am amazed. Thank you, I said, thinking he'd left out, you must not stop. Very kind. A business card appeared between his fingers. It was like watching a street busker do a magic trick, or would have been if street buskers wore Armani suits. If there's anything I can do, I've written my phone numbers on the back, home, cell, office. Very kind, I repeated. I couldn't think of anything else to say, and really, what did Mr. Vestic think I was going to do? Call him at home and thank him again? Ask him for a loan and offer him a painting as collateral? May I bring my wife over later and introduce her? He asked, and I saw a look in his eyes. It wasn't exactly like the look that had been in Wireman's when he realized that I'd put the blocks to Candy Brown. But it was close, as if Vestic were a little afraid of me. Of course, I said, and he slipped away. You used to build banks for guys like that and then have to fight them when they didn't want to pay the overage, Angel said. He was in a blue off-the-rack suit and looked on the verge of bursting out of it in 9 different directions, like the Incredible Hulk. Back then he would have thought you were just some moke trying to mess up his day. Now he looks at you like you could shit gold belt buckles. Angel, you stop, Helen Slobotnik cried, simultaneously throwing another elbow and grabbing for a glass of champagne. He held it serenely out of her reach. Tell her it's the truth, boss. I think it sort of is, I said. And it wasn't only the banker I was getting that look from. The women, geez. When my eyes met theirs, I caught a softening, a speculation, as if they were wondering how I might hold them with only one arm. That was probably crazy, but... I was grabbed from behind, almost yanked off my feet. My own glass of champagne would have spilled, but Angel snatched it deftly. I turned, and there was Kathy Green smiling at me. She had left the rehab Gestapo far behind, at least for tonight. She was wearing a short, shimmery green dress that clung to every well-maintained inch of her, and in her heels she stood almost to my forehead. Standing beside her, towering over her, was Cayman. His enormous eyes swam benevolently behind his horn-rimmed glasses. "Jesus, Kathy," I cried. "What would you have done if you'd knocked me over?"
"Made you give me 50," she said, smiling more widely than ever. Her eyes were full of tears. "Told you that on the phone. Look at your tan, you handsome boy."
The tears spilled over and she hugged me. I hugged back, then shook hands with Cayman. His hand swallowed mine whole.
"Your plane is the way for men my size to fly," he said,
and people turned in his direction. He had one of those deep James Earl Jones voices that can make supermarket circulars sound like the Book of Isaiah.
"I enjoyed myself to the max, Edgar."
"It's not really mine, but thank you," I said. "Have either of you..."
"Mr. Fremantle?"
There was a lovely redhead whose generously freckled breasts were in danger of tumbling from the top of a fragile pink dress. She had big green eyes. She looked about my daughter Melinda's age. Before I could say anything, she reached out and gently grasped my fingers.
"I just wanted to touch the hand that painted those pictures," she said. "Those wonderful, freaky pictures. God, you're amazing."
She lifted my hand and kissed it. Then she pressed it to one of her breasts. I could feel the rough pebble of nipple through a thin gauze of chiffon. Then she was gone into the crowd.
"Does that happen often?"
Cayman asked. And at the same moment, Kathy asked, "So how's the divorce treating you, Edgar?" They looked at each other for a moment, then burst out laughing. I understood what they were laughing at, Edgar's Elvis moment. But to me it just seemed weird. The rooms of the Scoto began to look a little like chambers in an undersea grotto, and I realized I could paint it that way. Undersea rooms with paintings on their walls, paintings that were being looked at by schooling peoplefish while Neptune's trio burbled Octopus's Garden. Far too weird. I wanted Wireman and Jack, also not here yet. But even more, I wanted my people, Illy most of all. If I had them, maybe this would start to feel like reality again. I glanced toward the door.
"If you're looking for Pam and the girls, I expect they'll be right along," Cayman said.
Melinda had a problem with her dress and went up to change it at the last minute. Melinda, I thought, of course, it would be Mel. And that was when I saw them, threading their way through the crowd of artistic gawkers, looking very northern and out of place amid the tans. Tom Riley and William Bozeman III, the immortal Bozy, paced behind them in dark suits. They stopped to look at three of the early sketches, which Dario had set up near the door in a triptych. It was Ilsa who saw me first. She cried, "Daddy!" and then cut through the crowd like a PT boat with her sister just behind her. Lynn was tugging a tall young man in her wake. Pam waved and also started toward me. I left Cayman, Kathy, and the Slobotniks, Angel still holding my drink. Someone began, "Pardon me, Mr. Fremantle, I wonder if I could ask..." But I paid no attention. In that moment, all I could see was Ilsa's glowing face and joyous eyes. We met in front of the sign reading, "The Scoto Gallery presents The View from Duma, Paintings and Sketches by Edgar Fremantle." I was aware that she was wearing a powder blue dress I had never seen before, and that with her hair up and what seemed like a swan's length of neck showing, she looked startlingly adult. I was aware of an immense, almost overpowering love for her, and gratitude that she'd felt the same for me. It was in her eyes. Then I was holding her. A moment later, Melinda was there with her young man standing beside her, and above her, he was one long, tall helicopter.
I didn't have an arm for her and her sister both, but she had one for me. She grabbed me and kissed the side of my face. Bonsoir, Dad. Congratulations. Then Pam was in front of me, the woman I had called a quitting birch not so long ago. She was wearing a dark blue pantsuit, a light blue silk blouse, and a string of pearls, sensible earrings. Sensible but good-looking low heels. Full Minnesota, if I had ever seen it. She was obviously frightened to death by all the people and the strange environment, but there was a hopeful smile on her face just the same. Pam had been many things in the course of our marriage, but hopeless was never one of them. "Edgar?" Pam asked in a small voice. "Are we still friends?" "You better believe it," I said. I only kissed her briefly, but hugged her as thoroughly as a one-armed man can do it. Ilsa was holding on to me on one side. Melinda had the other, squeezing hard enough to hurt my ribs, but I didn't care. As if from a great distance, I heard the room erupt in spontaneous applause. "You look good," Pam whispered in my ear. "No, you look wonderful. I'm not sure I would have known you on the street." I stepped back a little, looking at her. "You look pretty fine yourself." She laughed, blushing, a stranger with whom I had once spent my nights. Makeup covers a multitude of sins. "Daddy, this is Rick Dussault," Melinda said. "Bonsoir and congratulations, Monsieur Fremantle," Rick said. He was holding a plain white box. He now held it out. "From Linny and me, un cadeau." "The gift?" I knew what un cadeau was, of course. The real revelation was the exotic lilt his accent gave to my daughter's nickname. It made me understand, in a way nothing else could, that she was now more his than mine. It seemed to me that the majority of the people in the gallery had gathered around to watch me open my present. Tom Riley had made it almost to Pam's shoulder. Bosie was next to him. From just behind them, Margaret Bozeman skated me a kiss from the heel of her palm. Next to her was Todd Jameson, the doctor who had saved my life. Two sets of aunts and uncles. Rudy Rudnick, my old secretary. Kamen, of course, he was impossible to miss. And Kathy by his side. They had all come. Everyone but Wireman and Jack. And I was beginning to wonder if something had happened to keep them away. But for the moment, that seemed secondary. I thought of waking up in my hospital bed, confused and separated from everything. By unremitting pain. Then I looked around at this and wondered how things could possibly have changed so completely. All these people had come back into my life for one night. I didn't want to cry, but I was pretty sure I was going to. I could feel myself starting to dissolve like a tissue in a cloudburst. "Open it, Daddy," Ilsa said. I could smell her perfume, something sweet and fresh. "Open it! Open it!" Good-natured voices from the packed circle watching us. I opened the box, pulled out some white tissue paper, and uncovered what I had expected. Although I had expected something jokey, and this was no joke. The beret Melinda and Rick had brought me from France was dark red velvet and smooth as silk to the touch. It had not come cheap. "This is too nice," I said. "No, Daddy," Melinda said, "not nice enough. We only hope it fits." I took it out of the box and held it up. The audience oohed appreciatively. Melinda and Rick looked at each other happily. And Pam, who felt Lynn somehow never got her proper share of affection or approval from me, and she was probably right, gave me a look that was positively radiant. Then I put the beret on. It was a perfect fit. Melinda reached up, made one tiny adjustment, faced the watching audience, turned her palms outward to me and said, "Voici mon père, ce magnifique artiste." They burst into applause and cries of "Bravo!" Ilsa kissed me. She was crying and laughing. I remember the white vulnerability of her neck and the feel of her lips just above my jaw. I was the belle of the ball, and I had my family around me. There was light and champagne and music. It happened 4 years ago, on the evening of April 15th. Between 7:45 and 8 o'clock, while the shadows on Palm Avenue were just beginning to take on the first faint tinges of blue. This is a memory I keep. 2. I toured them around, with Tom and Bosie and the rest of the Minnesota crowd tagging after. Many of those present might have been first-time gallery attendees, but they were polite enough to give us some space. Melinda paused for a full minute in front of Sunset with Sephora, then turned to me, almost accusingly. If you could do this all along, Dad, why in God's name did you waste 30 years of your life putting up county extension buildings? Melinda Jean, Pam said, but absently. She was looking toward the center of the room where the girl and ship paintings hung suspended. Well, it's true, Melinda said, isn't it? Honey, I didn't know. How can you have something this big inside you and not know? She demanded. I didn't have an answer for that, but Alice O'Coin rescued me. Edgar, Dario wondered if you could step into Jimmy's office for a few minutes. I'll be happy to escort your family into the main room and you can join them there. Okay. What do they want? Don't worry, they're all smiling, she said, and smiled herself. Go on, Edgar, Pam said. And to Alice, I'm used to him being called away. When we were married, it was a way of life. Dad, what does this red circle on the top of the frame mean? Ilsa asked. That it's sold, dear, Alice said. I paused to look at Sunset with Sephora as I started away, and, sure enough, there was a little red circle on the upper right corner of the frame. That was a good thing. It was nice to know the crowd here was composed of more than just lookers drawn by the novelty of a one-armed dauber. But I still felt a pang and wondered if it was normal to feel that way. I had no way of telling. I didn't know any other artists to ask. 3. Dario and Jimmy Yoshida were in the office. So was a man I'd never met before. Dario introduced him to me as Jacob Rosenblatt, the accountant who kept the Scotto's books in trim. My heart sank a little as I shook his hand, turning my own to do it because he offered the wrong one, as so many people do. Ah, but it's a righty's world. Dario, are we in trouble here? I asked. Dario placed a silver champagne bucket on Jimmy's desk. In it, reclining on a bed of crushed ice, was a bottle of Perrier Jouet. The stuff they were serving in the gallery was good, but not this good. The cork had been recently drawn. There was still faint breath drifting from the bottle's green mouth. "Does this look like trouble?" he asked. "I would have had Alice ask your family in as well, but the office is too freaking small. Two people who should be here right now are Wireman and Jack Cantori. Where the hell are they? I thought they were coming together." "So did I. Did you try Elizabeth Eastlake's house? Heron's Roost?" "Of course," Dario said. "Got nothing but the answering machine." "Not even Elizabeth's nurse? Anne-Marie?" He shook his head. "Just the answering machine." I started having visions of Sarasota Memorial. I don't like the sound of that. "Perhaps the three of them are on their way here right now," Rosenblatt said. "I think that's unlikely. She's gotten very frail and short of breath. Can't even use her walker anymore." "I'm sure the situation will resolve itself," Jimmy said. "Meanwhile, we should raise a glass."
"Must raise a glass, Edgar," Dario added.
"Thanks, you guys. That's very kind, and I'd be happy to have a drink with you, but my family's outside, and I want to walk around with them while they look at the rest of my pictures, if that's all right." Jimmy said, "Understandable, but..." Dario interrupted, speaking quietly.
"Edgar, the show's a sell."
I looked at him. "Beg your pardon?" "We didn't think you'd had a chance to get around and see all the red dots," Jimmy said. He was smiling, his color so high he might have been blushing.
"Every painting and sketch that was for sale has been sold."
Jacob Rosenblatt, the accountant, said, 30 paintings and 14 sketches, it's unheard of." "But..." My lips felt numb. I watched as Dario turned, and this time took a tray of glasses from the shelf behind the desk. They were in the same floral pattern as the Perrier Jouet bottle. "But the price you put on girl and ship number 7 was $40,000. From the pocket of his plain black suit, Rosenblatt took a curl of paper that had to have come from an adding machine. "The paintings fetched $487,000, the sketches an additional $19,000, the total comes to a little over $500,000. It's the greatest sum the Scotto has ever taken in during the exhibition of a single artist's work. An amazing coup. Congratulations.
All of them?
I said in a voice so tiny I could hardly hear it myself. I looked at Dario as he put a champagne glass in my hand. He nodded.
If you had decided to sell girl and ship number 8, I believe that one alone would have fetched $100,000.
Twice that, Jimmy said. To Edgar Fremantle, at the start of his brilliant career, Rosenblatt said and raised his glass. We raised our glasses and drank, not knowing that my brilliant career was, for all practical purposes, at an end. We caught a break there, muchacho. 4. Tom Riley fell in beside me as I moved back through the crowd toward my family, smiling and shaking conversational gambits as fast as I could.
Boss, these are incredible, he said. But they're a little spooky, too.
I guess that's a compliment, I said.
The truth was, talking to Tom felt spooky, knowing what I did about him.
It's definitely a compliment, he said. Listen, you're headed for your family. I'll take a hike. And he started to do just that, but I grabbed him by the elbow.
Stick with me, I said. Together we can repel all borders. On my own, I may not get to Pam and the girls until 9 o'clock. He laughed.
Old Tommy looked good.
He'd added some pounds since that day at Lake Phelan, but I'd read that antidepressants sometimes do that, especially to men. On him, a little more weight was okay. The hollows under his eyes had filled in.
How have you been, Tom?
Well, in truth, depressed.
He lifted one hand in the air as if to wave off a commiseration I hadn't offered.
It's a chemical imbalance thing, and it's a bitch getting used to the pills. They muddy up your thinking at first. They did mine, anyway. I went off them a while, but I'm back on now, and life's looking better. It's either the fake endorphins kicking in or the effect of springtime in the land of a billion lakes.
And the Fremantle Company?
The books are in the black, but it's not the same without you. I came down here thinking I might pitch you on coming back. Then I got a look at what you're doing, and I realized your days in the building biz are probably done.
I think so, yeah. He gestured toward the canvases in the main room.
What are they, really? I mean, no bullshit, because I wouldn't say this to very many people. They remind me of the way life was inside my head when I wasn't taking my pills.
They're just make-believe, I said. Shadows.
I know about shadows, he said.
You just want to be careful they don't grow teeth, because they can. Then, sometimes when you reach for the light switch to make them go away, you discover the power's out.
But you're better now.
Yes, he said. Pam had a lot to do with that. Can I tell you something about her you might already know?
Sure, I said, only hoping he wasn't going to share the fact that she sometimes laughed way down in her throat when she came.
She has great insight, but little kindness, Tom said. It's a weirdly cruel mix.
I said nothing, but not necessarily because I thought he was wrong.
She gave me a brisk talking to about taking care of myself not so long ago, and it hit home.
Yeah?
Yeah. And from the look of her, you might be in for talking to yourself, Edgar. I think I might find your friend Cayman and engage him in a bit of discourse. Excuse me.
The girls and Rick were staring up at Wireman Looks West and chattering animatedly. Pam, however, was positioned about halfway down the line of girl and ship paintings, which hung like movie posters, and she looked disturbed. Not angry, exactly, just disturbed, confused. She beckoned me over, and once I was there, she didn't waste time.
Is the little girl in these pictures Ilsa?
She pointed up at number 1.
I thought at first this one with the red hair was supposed to be the doll Dr. Cayman gave you after your accident, but Ilsa had a tic-tac-toe dress like that when she was little. I bought it at Romper's. And this one...
Now she pointed at number 3.
I swear this is the dress she just had to have to start first grade in. The one she was wearing when she broke her damn arm that night after the stock car races.
Well, there you were.
I remembered the broken arm as having come after church, but that was only a minor misstep in the grand dance of memory. There were more important things. One was that Pam was in a unique position to see through most of the smoke and mirrors that critics like to call art. At least in my case, she was. In that way, and probably in a great many others, she was still my wife. It seemed that in the end, only time could issue a divorce decree, and that the decree would be partial at best. I turned her toward me. We were being watched by a great many people, and I suppose to them it looked like an embrace. And in a way it was. I got one glimpse of her wide, startled eyes, and then I was whispering in her ear, "Yes, the girl in the rowboat is Ilsa. I never meant her to be there, because I never meant anything. I never even knew I was going to paint these pictures until I started doing them. And because she's back, too, no one else is ever going to know unless you or I tell them, and I won't, but—" I pulled back. Her eyes were still wide, her lips parted as if to receive a kiss. What did Ilsa say? The oddest thing. She took me by the sleeve and pulled me down to number 7 and number 8. In both of these, Rowboat Girl was wearing the green dress with straps that crossed over her bare back. She said you must be reading her mind because she ordered a dress like that from Newport News just this spring. She looked back at the pictures. I stood silently beside her and let her look. I don't like these, Edgar. They're not like the others, and I don't like them. I thought of Tom Riley saying, "Your ex has great insight, but little kindness." Pam lowered her voice. "You don't know something about Illy that you shouldn't, do you? The way you knew about—" "No," I said. But I was more troubled by the girl and ship series than ever. Some of it was seeing them all hung in a line. The accumulated weirdness was like a punch. Sell them. That was Elizabeth's opinion. However many there are, you must sell them. And I could understand why she thought so. I did not like seeing my daughter, not even in the guise of the child she had long outgrown, in such close proximity to that rotted sheer hulk. And in a way, I was surprised that perplexity and disquiet were all Pam felt, but of course, the paintings hadn't had a chance to work on her yet. And they were no longer on Duma Key. The young people joined us, Rick and Melinda, with their arms round each other. "Daddy, you're a genius," Melinda said. "Rick thinks so too, don't you, Rick?" "Actually," Rick said, "I do. I came prepared to be polite. Instead, I am struggling for the words to say I am amazed." "That's very kind," I said. "Merci." "I'm so proud of you, Dad," Illy said and hugged me. Pam rolled her eyes, and in that instant I could cheerfully have whacked her one. Instead, I folded Ilsa into my arms and kissed the top of her head. As I did, Mary Iyer's voice rose from the front of the Scoto in a cigarette-hoarsened shout that was full of amazed disbelief. "Libby Eastlake, I don't believe my goddamned eyes." It was my ears I didn't believe, but when a spontaneous spatter of applause erupted from the doorway, where the real aficionados had gathered to chat and take a little fresh evening air, I understood why Jack and Wireman had been late. 5. "What?" Pam asked. "What?" I had her on one side and Illy on the other as I moved toward the door. Linny and Rick bobbed along in our wake. The applause grew louder. People turned toward the door and craned to see. "Who is it, Edgar?" "My best friends on the island." Then to Ilsa. "One of them's the lady from down the road, remember her? She turned out to be the daughter of the godfather instead of the bride. Her name's Elizabeth Eastlake and she's a sweetheart." Ilsa's eyes were shining with excitement. "The old gal in the big blue sneakers." The crowd, many of them still applauding, parted for us, and I saw the three of them in the reception area, where two tables with a punch bowl on each had been set up. My eyes began to sting and a lump rose in my throat. Jack was dressed in a slate gray suit, with his usually unruly surfer's thatch tamed. He looked like either a junior executive in the Bank of America or an especially tall seventh grader on Careers Day. Wireman, pushing Elizabeth's chair, was wearing faded beltless jeans and a round-collared white linen shirt that emphasized his deep tan. His hair was combed back, and I realized for the first time that he was good-looking the way Harrison Ford was in his late 40s. But it was Elizabeth who stole the show. Elizabeth, who elicited the applause, even from the newbies who hadn't the slightest idea who she was. She was wearing a black pantsuit of dull, rough cotton, loose but elegant. Her hair was up and held with a gauzy snood that flashed like diamonds beneath the gallery's downlighters. From her neck hung an ivory scrimshaw pendant on a gold chain, and on her feet were not big blue Frankenstein sneakers, but elegant pumps of darkest scarlet. Between the second and third fingers of her gnarled left hand was an unlit cigarette in a gold-chased holder. She looked left and right, smiling. When Mary came to the chair, Wireman stopped pushing long enough for the younger woman to kiss Elizabeth's cheek and whisper in her ear. Elizabeth listened, nodded, then whispered back. Mary cawed laughter, then caressed Elizabeth's arm. Someone brushed by me. It was Jacob Rosenblatt, the accountant, his eyes wet and his nose red. Dario and Jimmy were behind him. Rosenblatt knelt by her wheelchair, his bony knees cracking like starter pistols, and cried, "Miss Eastlake, oh, Miss Eastlake, so long we're not seeing you, and now, oh, what a wonderful surprise." "And you, Jake," she said, and cradled his bald head to her bosom. It looked like a very large egg laying there. "Handsome as Bogart." She saw me and winked. I winked back, but it wasn't easy to keep my happy face on. She looked haggard, dreadfully tired in spite of her smile. I raised my eyes to Wireman's and he gave the tiniest of shrugs. "She insisted," it said. I switched my gaze to Jack and got much the same. Rosenblatt, meanwhile, was rummaging in his pockets. At last, he came up with a book of matches so battered it looked as if it might have entered the United States without a passport at Ellis Island. He opened it and tore one out. "I thought smoking was against the rules in all these public buildings now," Elizabeth said. Rosenblatt struggled. Color rose up in his neck. I almost expected his head to explode. Finally, he exclaimed, "Fuck the rules, Miss Eastlake." "Bravissimo," Mary shouted, laughing and throwing her hands to the ceiling. And at this there was another round of applause. A greater one came when Rosenblatt finally got the ancient match to ignite and held it out to Elizabeth, who placed her cigarette holder between her lips. "Who is she really, Daddy?" Ilsa asked softly. "Besides the little old lady who lives down the lane, I mean." I said, "According to reports, at one time she was the Sarasota art scene." "I don't understand why that gives her the right to muck up our lungs with her cigarette smoke," Linny said. The vertical line was returning between her brows. Rick smiled. "Oh, Sherry. This after all the bars we..." "This is not there," she said, the vertical line deepening, and I thought, "Rick, you may be French, but you have a lot to learn about this particular American woman." Alice O'Coyne murmured to Dario, and from his pocket Dario produced an Altoids tin. He dumped the mints into the palm of his hand and gave Alice the tin. Alice gave it to Elizabeth, who thanked her and tapped her cigarette ash into it. Pam watched, fascinated, then turned to me. "What does she think of your pictures?" "I don't know," I said. "She hasn't seen them." Elizabeth was beckoning to me. "Will you introduce me to your family, Edgar?" I did, beginning with Pam and ending with Rick. Jack and Wireman also shook hands with Pam and the girls. "After all the calls, I'm pleased to meet you in the flesh," Wireman told Pam. "The same goes back to you," Pam said, sizing him up. She must have liked what she saw, because she smiled, and it was the real one, the one that lights her whole face. "We did it, didn't we? He didn't make it easy, but we did it." "Art is never easy, young woman," Elizabeth said. Pam looked down at her, still smiling the genuine smile, the one I'd fallen in love with. "Do you know how long it's been since anyone called me young woman?" "Ah, but to me you look very young and beautiful," Elizabeth said,
And was this the woman who had been little more than a muttering lump of cheese slumped in her wheelchair only a week ago? Tonight that seemed hard to believe. Tired as she looked, it seemed impossible to believe. But not as young and beautiful as your daughters. Girls, your father is, by all accounts, a very talented fellow.
We're very proud of him, Melinda said, twisting her necklace.
Elizabeth smiled at her, then turned to me. I should like to see the work and judge for myself. Will you indulge me, Edgar?
I'd be happy to. I meant it, but I was damn nervous as well. Part of me was afraid to receive her opinion. That part was afraid she might shake her head and deliver her verdict with the bluntness to which her age entitled her.
Facile, colorful, certainly lots of energy, but perhaps not up to much, in the end.
Wireman moved to grasp the handles of her chair, but she shook her head.
No, let Edgar push me, Wireman. Let him tour me.
She plucked the half-smoked cigarette from the holder, those gnarled fingers doing the job with surprising dexterity, and crushed it out on the bottom of the tin.
And the young lady's right. I think we've all had quite enough of this reek.
Melinda had the grace to blush. Elizabeth offered the tin to Rosenblatt, who took it with a smile and a nod. I've wondered since then, I know it's morbid, but yes, I've wondered, if she would have smoked more of it if she had known it was to be her last.
6.
Even those who didn't know John Eastlake's surviving daughter from a hole in the wall understood that a personage had come among them. And the tidal flow, which had moved toward the reception area at the sound of Mary Iyer's exuberant shout, now reversed itself as I rolled the wheelchair into the alcove where most of the Sunset With pictures had been hung. Wireman and Pam walked on my left. Ilsa and Jack were on my right. Ilsa giving the wheelchair's handle on that side little helping taps to make sure it stayed on course. Melinda and Rick were behind us, Kame and Tom Riley and Bosie behind them. Behind that trio came seemingly everyone else in the gallery. I wasn't sure there would be room to get her chair in between the makeshift bar set up in the wall, but there was, just. I started to push it down that narrow aisle, grateful that we'd at least be leaving the rest of the retinue behind us, when Elizabeth cried,
"Stop!"
I stopped at once.
"Elizabeth, are you all right?"
"Just a minute, honey. Hush."
We sat there looking at the paintings on the wall. After a little bit, she fetched a sigh and said, "Wyman, do you have a Kleenex?"
He had a handkerchief, which he unfolded and handed to her.
"Come round here, Edgar," she said. "Come where I can see you."
I managed to get around between the wheelchair and the bar, with the bartender bracing the table to make sure it didn't tip over.
"Are you able to kneel down so we can be face to face?"
I was able. My great beach walks were paying dividends. She clutched her cigarette holder, both foolish and somehow magnificent, in one hand, Wireman's handkerchief in the other. Her eyes were damp.
"You read me poems because Wyman couldn't. Do you remember that?"
"Yes, ma'am." Of course I remembered. Those had been sweet interludes.
"If I were to say, speak memory to you, you'd think of the man, I can't recall his name, who wrote Lolita, wouldn't you?"
I had no idea who she was talking about, but I nodded.
"But there's a poem, too. I can't remember who wrote it, but it begins, speak memory that I may not forget the taste of roses, nor the sound of ashes in the wind, that I may once more taste the green cup of the sea. Does it move you?" "Yes, I see it does."
The hand with the cigarette holder in it opened, then it reached out and caressed my hair. The idea occurred to me, and has since recurred, that all my struggle to live and regain a semblance of myself may have been paid back by no more than the touch of that old woman's hand, the eroded smoothness of the palm, the bent strength of those fingers.
"Art is memory, Edgar. There is no simpler way to say it. The clearer the memory, the better the art, the purer. These paintings, they break my heart and then make it new again. How glad I am to know they were done at Salmon Point. No matter what.
She lifted the hand she'd caressed my head with. Tell me what you call that one.
Sunset with Sephora.
And these are what? Sunset with Conch, numbers 1 through 4?
I smiled.
Well, there were 16 of them, actually, starting with colored pencil sketches. Some of those are out front. I picked the best oils for in here. They're surreal, I know, but they're not surreal. They're classical. Any fool can see that. They contain all the elements, earth, air, water, fire.
I saw Wireman mouth, don't tire her out.
Why don't I give you a quick tour of the rest, then get you a cold drink? I asked her. And now Wireman was nodding and giving me a thumb and forefinger circle. It's hot in here, even with the air conditioning.
Fine, she said. I am a little tired, but Edgar...
Yes.
Save the ship paintings for the last. After them, I'll need a drink. Perhaps in the office. Just one, but something stiffer than Coca-Cola.
You got it, I said, and edged my way back to the rear of the chair.
10 minutes, Wireman whispered in my ear. No more.
I'd want to get her out before Gene Hadlock shows up, if possible.
He sees her, he's going to shit a brick.
And you know who he'll throw it at.
10, I said, and rolled Elizabeth into the buffet room to look at the paintings in there.
The crowd was still following. Mary Eyre had begun taking notes. Ilsa slipped one hand into the crook of my elbow and smiled at me. I smiled back, but I was having that I'm-in-a-dream feeling again, the kind that may tilt you into a nightmare at any moment. Elizabeth exclaimed over I See the Moon and the Duma Road series, but it was the way she reached her hand out to Roses Grow from Shells, as if to embrace it, that gave me goosebumps. She lowered her arms again and looked over her shoulder at me.
That's the essence of it, she said, the essence of Duma. Why those who've lived there a while can never really leave. Even if their heads carry their bodies away, their hearts stay.
She looked at the picture again and nodded.
Roses grow from shells.
That is correct.
Thank you, Elizabeth.
No, Edgar. Thank you.
I glanced back for Wireman and saw him talking to that other lawyer from my other life. They seemed to be getting along famously. I only hoped Wireman wouldn't slip and call him Bosie.
Then I turned to Elizabeth again. She was still looking at Roses Grow from Shells and wiping her eyes.
I love this, she said, but we should move along.
After she'd seen the other paintings and sketches in the buffet room, she said, as if to herself,
Of course I knew someone would come, but I never would have guessed it would be someone who could produce works of such power and sweetness.
Jack tapped me on the shoulder, then leaned close to murmur in my ear.
Dr. Hadlock has entered the building. Wireman wants you to speed this up if you can.
The main gallery where the girl and ship paintings hung was on the way to the office, and Elizabeth could leave by the loading door and back after having her drink. It would actually be more convenient for her wheelchair. Hadlock could accompany her if he so desired. But I dreaded taking her past the ship series, and it was no longer her critical opinion I was worried about.
Come on, she said, and clicked her amethyst ring on the arm of her wheelchair. Let's look at them. No hesitating.
All right, I said, and began pushing her toward the main gallery.
Are you all right, Eddie?
Pam asked in a low voice.
Fine, I said.
You're not. What's wrong?
I only shook my head.
We were in the main room now. The pictures were suspended at a height of about 6 feet. The room was otherwise open. The walls, covered with coarse brown stuff that looked like burlap, were bare except for Wireman Looks West. I rolled Elizabeth's chair slowly along. The wheels were soundless on the pale blue carpet. The murmur of the crowd behind us had either stopped or my ears had filtered it out. I seemed to see the paintings for the first time, and they looked oddly like stills culled from a strip of movie film. Each image was a little clearer, a little more in focus, but always essentially the same, always the ship I had first glimpsed in a dream. It was always sunset, and the light filling the west was always a titanic red anvil that spread blood across the water and infected the sky. The ship was a three-masted corpse, something that had floated in from a plague house of the dead. Its sails were rags, its deck was deserted. There was something horrible in every angular line, and although it was impossible to say just what, you feared for the little girl alone in her rowboat. The little girl who first appeared in a tic-tac-toe dress. The little girl afloat on the wine-dark gulf. In that first version, the angle of the death ship was wrong to see anything of the name. In Girl in Ship Number 2, the angle had improved, but the little girl, still with the false red hair, and now also wearing Reba's polka-dotted dress, blocked out all but the letter P. In Number 3, P had become P-E-R, and Reba had pretty clearly become Ilsa, even back too. John Eastlake's spear pistol lay in the rowboat. If Elizabeth recognized this, she gave no indication. I pushed her slowly up the line as the ship bulked larger and closer, its black masts looming like fingers, its sails sagging. The furnace sky glared through the holes in the canvas. Now the name on the transom was Percy. There might have been more. There was room for more, but if so, it was hidden by the shadows. In Girl in Ship Number 6, the ship now looming over the rowboat, the little girl was wearing what appeared to be a blue singlet with a yellow stripe around the neck. Her hair in that one was orangish. It was the only rowboat girl whose identity I wasn't sure of. Maybe it was Ilsa, since the others were, but I wasn't entirely convinced. In this one, the first few rose petals had begun to appear on the water, plus one single yellow-green tennis ball with the letters D-U-N-L visible on it, and an odd assortment of gewgaws were heaped on deck. A tall mirror, which, reflecting the sunset, appeared filled with blood. A child's rocking horse, a steamer trunk, a pile of shoes. These same objects appeared in Number 7 and Number 8, where they had been joined by several others, a young girl's bicycle leaning against the foremast, a pile of tires stacked on the stern, a great hourglass at midships. This last also reflected the sun and appeared to be full of blood instead of sand. In Girl in Ship Number 8, there were more rose petals floating between the rowboat and the Percy. There were more tennis balls, too, at least half a dozen, and a rotting garland of flowers hung around the neck of the rocking horse. I could almost smell the stench of their perfume on the still air. "Dear God," Elizabeth whispered. "She has grown so strong." There had been color in her face, but now it was all gone. She didn't look 85, she looked 200. "Who?" I tried to ask, but nothing came out. "Ma'am, Miss Eastlake, you shouldn't tax yourself," Pam said. I cleared my throat. "Can you get her a glass of water?" "I will, Dad," Illy said. Elizabeth was still staring at Girl in Ship Number 8. "How many of those souvenirs do you recognize?" she asked. "I don't. My imagination..." I fell silent. The girl in the rowboat of Number 8 was no souvenir, but she was Ilsa. The green dress with its bare back and crisscrossing straps had seemed jarringly sexy for a little girl. But now I knew why. It was a dress Ilsa had bought recently from a mail-order catalog, and Ilsa was no longer a little girl. Otherwise, the tennis balls were still a mystery to me. The mirror meant nothing, nor did the stack of tires, and I didn't know for a fact that the bicycle leaning against the foremast had been Tina Garibaldi's, but I feared it, and my heart was somehow sure of it. Elizabeth's hand, dreadfully cold, settled on my wrist. "There's no bullet on the frame of this last one." "I don't know what you're..." Her grip tightened. "You do. You know exactly what I mean. The show is a sell, Edgar. Do you think I'm blind? A bullet on the frame of every painting we looked at, including Number 6, the one with my sister Addie in the rowboat. But not this one." I looked back toward number 6 where Rowboat Girl had orange hair. That's your sister? She paid no attention. I don't think she even heard me. All her attention was bent upon girl and ship number 8. What do you mean to do? Take it back? Do you mean to take it back to Duma? Her voice rang out in the quiet of the gallery. Ma'am, Miss Eastlake, you really shouldn't excite yourself this way, Pam said. Elizabeth's eyes blazed in the hanging flesh of her face. Her nails dug into the scant meat of my wrist. And what? Put it next to another one you've already started? I haven't started another. Or had I? My memory was playing me again, as it often did in moments of stress. If someone had at that moment demanded that I speak the name of my older daughter's French boyfriend, I probably would have said René, as in Magritte. The dream had tilted all right. Here was the nightmare, right on schedule. The one where the rowboat is empty? Before I could say anything, Jean Hadlock shoved through a crowd, followed by wiremen, followed by Ilsa holding a glass of water. Elizabeth, we should go, Hadlock said. He reached for her arm. Elizabeth swept his hand away. On the follow-through, she struck the glass Ilsa was starting to proffer, and it went flying, hitting one of the bare walls and shattering. Someone cried out, and some woman incredibly laughed. Do you see the rocking horse, Edgar? She held out her hand. It was trembling badly. Her nails had been painted coral pink, probably by Anne-Marie.
That belonged to my sisters, Tessie and Laura. They loved it. They dragged that damned thing with them everywhere. It was outside Rampopo, the baby playhouse on the side lawn, after they drowned. My father couldn't bear to look at it. He had thrown it into the water at the memorial service, along with the garland, of course. The one around the horse's neck.
Silence except for the tearing rasp of her breath. Mary Eyre staring with big eyes, her obsessive note-taking at an end, the pad hanging forgotten in one hand by her side. Her other hand had gone to her mouth. Then Wireman pointed to a door that was quite cleverly concealed in more of the brown burlappy stuff. Hadlock nodded. And suddenly Jack was there. And it was actually Jack who took charge. "Have you out in a jiff, Miss Eastlake," he said. "No worries." He seized the handles of her wheelchair.
"Look at the ship's wake,"
Elizabeth shouted at me as she was borne out of the public eye for the last time.
"For Christ's sake, don't you see what you've painted?"
I looked. So did my family. "There's nothing there," Melinda said. She looked mistrustfully toward the office door, which was just closing behind Jack and Elizabeth. "Is she dotty or what?" Illy was standing on tiptoe, craning for a closer look.
"Daddy," she said hesitantly, "are those faces? Faces in the water?"
"No," I said, surprised at the steadiness of my own voice. "All you're seeing is an idea she put in your head. Will you guys excuse me for a minute?"
"Of course," Pam said.
"May I be of assistance, Edgar?" Cayman asked in his booming basso. I smiled. I was surprised at how easily that came too. Shock has its purposes, it seems. "Thanks, but no. Her doctor's in with her." I hurried toward the office door, resisting an urge to look back. Melinda hadn't seen it. Ilsa had. My guess was that not many people would, even if it were pointed out to them. And even then, most would dismiss it as either coincidence or a small artistic wink. Those faces. Those screaming, drowned faces in the ship's sunset wake. Tessie and Laura were there, most certainly. But others as well. Just below them, where the red faded to green and the green to black. One might be a carrot-topped girl in an old-fashioned singlet-style bathing suit. Elizabeth's older sister, Adriana.
7. Wireman was giving her sips of what looked like Perrier while Rosenblatt fussed at her side, literally wringing his hands. The office seemed packed with people. It was hotter than the gallery, and getting hotter.
"I want you all out," Hadlock said. "Everyone but Wireman. Now, right now."
Elizabeth pushed aside the glass with the back of her hand.
"Edgar," she said in a husky voice.
Edgar stays. No, Edgar goes, Hadlock said. You've excited yourself quite an... His hand was in front of her. She seized it and squeezed it, with some force, it seemed, because Hadlock's eyes widened. Stays. It was only a whisper, but a powerful one. People began to leave. I heard Dario telling the crowd gathered outside that everything was fine. Miss Eastlake felt a little faint, but her doctor was with her and she was recovering. Jack was going out the door when Elizabeth called, "Young man." He turned. "Don't forget," she told him. He gave her a brief grin and knocked off a salute. "No, ma'am, I sure won't."
"I should have trusted you in the first place," she said,
and Jack went out. Then, in a lower voice, as if her strength were fading,
"He's a good boy."
"Trusted him for what?" Wireman asked her.
"To search the attic for a certain picnic basket," she said. "In the picture on the landing, Nan Melda is holding it."
She looked at me reproachfully. "I'm sorry," I said. "I remember you telling me, but I got painting and..."
"I don't blame you," she said.
Her eyes had receded deep in their sockets.
"I should have known. It's her power. The same power that drew you here in the first place."
She looked at Wireman.
"And you."
"Elizabeth, that's enough," Hadlock said. "I want to take you to the hospital and run some tests, run some fluids into you while I'm at it, get you some rest."
"I'll be getting all the rest I need very soon now,"
she told him and smiled. The smile exposed a large and rather gruesome ring of dentures. Her eyes returned to me.
"Trixie, Pixie, Nixie," she said. "To her it's all a game, all our sorrow, and she's awake again."
Her hand, very cold, settled on my forearm.
"Edgar, she's awake."
"Who? Elizabeth, who? Percy?" She shuddered backward in her chair. It was as if an electrical current were passing through her. The hand on my arm tightened. Her coral nails punched through my skin, leaving a quartet of red crescents. Her mouth opened, exposing her teeth this time in a snarl instead of a smile. Her head went backward, and I heard something in there snap. "Catch the chair before it goes over," Wireman roared, but I couldn't. I had only one arm, and Elizabeth was clutching it, was docked in it. Hadlock grabbed one of the push handles, and the chair skittered sideways instead of toppling backwards. It struck Jimmy Yoshida's desk. Now Elizabeth was in full seizure mode, jittering back and forth in her chair like a puppet. The snood came loose from her hair and flailed, sparkling in the light of the overhead fluorescence. Her feet jerked, and one of her scarlet pumps went flying off. "The angels want to wear my red shoes," I thought. And as if the line had summoned it, blood burst from her nose and mouth. "Hold her!" Hadlock shouted, and Wireman threw himself across the arms of the chair. "She did this," I thought coldly. "Percy, whoever she is." "I've got her," Wireman said. "Call 911, Doc, for Christ's sake." Hadlock hurried around the desk, picked up the phone, dialed, listened. "Fuck! I just get more dial tone." I snatched it from him. "You must have to dial 9 for an outside line," I said, and did it with the phone cradled between my ear and shoulder. And when the calm-voiced woman on the other end asked me the nature of my emergency, I was able to tell her. It was the address I couldn't remember. I couldn't even remember the name of the gallery. I handed the phone to Hadlock and went back around the desk to Wireman. "Christ Jesus," he said. "I knew I shouldn't have brought her. I knew, but she was so fucking insistent." "Is she out?" I looked at her slumped in her chair. Her eyes were open, but they looked vacantly at a point in the far corner. "Elizabeth?" There was no response. "Was it a stroke?" Wireman asked. "I never knew they could be so violent." "That was no stroke. Something shut her up. Go to the hospital with her."
"Of course I'll go.
And if she says anything else, listen." Hadlock came back. "They're waiting for her at the hospital. An ambulance will be here any minute." He stared hard at Wireman, then his look softened. "Oh, all right," he said.
Oh, all right, Wireman asked. What does that mean, oh, all right?
It means if something like this was going to happen, Padlock said, where do you think she would have wanted it to happen? At home in bed or in one of the galleries where she spent so many happy days and nights?
Wireman took in a deep, shaky breath, let it out, nodded, then knelt beside her and began to brush at her hair. Elizabeth's face was patchy red in places and bloated, as if she were having an extreme allergic reaction.
Padlock bent and tilted her head back, trying to ease her terrible rasping. Not long after, we heard the approaching warble of the ambulance. 8. The show dragged on and I stuck it out, partly because of all the effort Dario, Jimmy, and Alice had put into the thing, but mostly for Elizabeth. I thought it was what she would have wanted. My moment in the sun, she'd called it. I didn't go to the celebratory dinner afterwards, though. I made my excuses, then sent Pam and the girls on with Cayman, Kathy, and some of the others from Minneapolis. Watching them pull away, I realized I hadn't made arrangements for a ride to the hospital. While I was standing there in front of the gallery, wondering if Alice or Coyne had left yet, a beat-to-shit old Mercedes pulled up beside me, and the passenger window slid down. Get in, Mary Iyer said. If you're going to Sarasota Memorial, I'll drop you off. She saw me hesitate and smiled crookedly. Mary's had very little to drink tonight, I assure you, and in any case, the Sarasota traffic goes from clogged to almost zero after 10 p.m. The old folks take their scotch and Prozac and then curl up to watch Bill O'Reilly on TiVo. I got in. The door clunked when it shut, and for one alarming moment I thought my ass was going to keep descending until it was actually on Palm Avenue. Finally, my downward motion stopped. Listen, Edgar, she said, then hesitated. Can I still call you Edgar?
Of course.
She nodded.
Lovely.
I couldn't remember with perfect clarity what sort of terms we parted on. Sometimes when I drink too much... She shrugged her bony shoulders. We're fine, I said.
Good.
As for Elizabeth, not so good, is it? I shook my head, not trusting myself to speak. The streets were almost deserted, as promised. The sidewalks were dead empty. She and Jake Rosenblatt were a thing for a while. It was pretty serious.
What happened?
Mary shrugged. Can't say for sure. If you forced me to guess, I'd say that in the end she was just too used to being her own mistress to be anyone else's, other than on a part-time basis, that is. But Jake never got over her. I remembered him saying, "Fuck the rules, Miss Eastlake," and wondered what he had called her in bed. Surely not Miss Eastlake. It was a sad and useless bit of speculation. Maybe this is for the best, Mary said. She was guttering. If you'd known her in her prime, Edgar, you'd know she wasn't the sort of woman who'd want to go out that way.
I wish I had known her in her prime.
Can I do anything for your family?
No, I said.
They're having dinner with Dario and Jimmy and the whole state of Minnesota. I'll join them later if I can, maybe for dessert. And I'm booked into the Ritz, where they're all staying. If nothing else, I'll see them in the morning.
That's nice.
They seemed nice. And understanding. Pam actually seemed more understanding now than before the divorce. Of course, now I was down here painting and not up there yelling at her, or trying to staff her with a butterfife. I'm going to praise your shows to the skies, Edgar. I doubt if that means much to you tonight, but perhaps it will later on. The paintings are just extraordinary.
Thank you.
Ahead, the lights of the hospital were twinkling in the dark. There was a Waffle House right next door. It was probably good business for the cardiac unit. Will you give Libby my love, if she's in any condition to take note of such things?
Sure.
And I have something for you. It's in the glove compartment, manila envelope. I was going to use it to bait the hook for a follow-up interview, but fuck it. I had some problems with the old car's glove compartment button, but finally the little door fell open like a corpse's mouth. There was a lot more than a manila envelope in there. A geologist could have taken core samples probably going back to 1965,
but the envelope was in front and it had my name printed on it. As she pulled up in front of the hospital in a spot marked 5 minutes pick-up and drop-off, Mary said, "Prepare to be amazed. I was. An old copy editor friend of mine chased that down for me. She's older than Libby, but still sharp." I bent back the clasps and slid out 2 Xeroxed sheets of an ancient newspaper story. "That," Mary said, "is from the Port Charlotte Weekly Echo, June of 1925. It's got to be the story my friend Aggie saw, and the reason I could never find it is because I never looked as far south as Port Charlotte. Also, the Weekly Echo gave up the ghost in 1931. The streetlight beneath which she'd parked wasn't good enough for the fine print, but I could read the headline and see the picture. I looked for a long time. "It means something to you, doesn't it?" she asked.
"Yes. I just don't know what."
"If you figure it out, will you tell me?"
"All right," I said.
"You might even believe it.
But Mary, this is one story you'll never print. Thanks for the ride. And thanks for coming to my show.
Both my pleasure. Remember to give Libby my love."
"I will." But I never did. I had seen Elizabeth Eastlake for the last time.
This audiobook has been broken into multiple parts to make the download faster. You have reached the end of a part, but not the end of the complete audiobook. So please check your library for the next part of this audiobook.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.
This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Duma Key by Stephen King. Read by John Slattery.
Nine. The ICU nurse on duty told me that Elizabeth was in surgery. When I asked for what, she told me she wasn't sure. I looked around the waiting room. "If you're looking for Mr. Wireman, I believe he went to the cafeteria for coffee," the nurse said. "That's on the fourth floor."
"Thanks." I started away, then turned back.
"Is Dr. Hadlock part of the surgical team?"
"I don't think so," she said, "but he's observing."
I thanked her again and went in search of Wireman. I found him in a far corner of the caf, sitting in front of a paper cup about the size of a World War II mortar shell. Except for a scattering of nurses and orderlies, and one tense-looking family group in another corner of the room, we had the place to ourselves. Most of the chairs were upended on the tables, and a tired-looking lady in red rayon was working out with a mop. An iPod hung in a sling between her breasts. "Hola, mi vato," Wireman said, and gave me a wan smile. His hair, neatly combed back when he made his entrance with Elizabeth and Jack, had fallen down around his ears, and there were dark circles around his eyes. "Why don't you grab yourself a cup of coffee? It tastes like factory-made shit, but it do prop up a person's eyelids."
"No, thanks. Just let me borrow a sip of yours."
I had 3 aspirin in my pants pocket. I fished them out and swallowed them with some of Wireman's coffee. He wrinkled his nose.
"In with all your germy change? That's nasty."
"I have a strong immune system."
"How is she?"
"Not good." He looked at me bleakly. "Did she come around at all in the ambulance? Say anything else?"
"She did."
"What?" From the pocket of his linen shirt, Wireman took an invitation to my show, with "The View from Duma" printed on one side. On the other, he'd scrawled 3 notes. They jagged up and down, from the motion of the ambulance, I assumed. But I could read them. "The table is leaking. You will want to, but you mustn't. Drown her back to sleep." They were all spooky, but that last one made the flesh on my arms prickle. "Nothing else?" I asked, handing the invitation back. "She said my name a couple of times. She knew me. And she said yours, Edgar." "Have a look at this," I said, and slid the manila envelope across the table. He asked where I'd gotten it, and I told him.
He said it all seemed a little convenient, and I shrugged. I was remembering something Elizabeth had said to me. The water runs faster now. Soon come the rapids. Well, the rapids were here. I had a feeling this was only the start of the white water. My hip was starting to feel a little better. It's late night sobbing down to mere sniffles. According to popular wisdom, a dog is man's best friend, but I would vote for aspirin. I pulled my chair around the table and sat next to Wireman, where I could read the headline, Duma Key Tot Blossoms Following Spill. Is she a child prodigy? Beneath was a photograph. In it was a man I knew well, in a bathing suit I knew well. John Eastlake in his slimmer, trimmer incarnation. He was smiling and holding up a smiling little girl. It was Elizabeth, looking the same age as in the family portrait of Daddy and his girls. Only now she was holding out a drawing to the camera in both hands and wearing a gauze bandage wrapped around her head. There was another, much older girl in the picture, Big Sister Adriana. And yes, she could have been a carrot top. But to begin with, Wireman and I paid little attention to her. Or to John Eastlake. Or even to the toddler with the bandage around her head. Holy wow, Wireman said. The picture was of a horse looking over a fence rail. It wore an unlikely and unequine smile. In the foreground, back too, was a little girl with lots of golden ringlets, holding out a carrot the size of a shotgun for the smiling horse to eat. To either side, bracketing the picture almost like theater curtains, were palm trees. Above were puffy white clouds and a great big sun, shooting off happy rays of light. It was a child's picture, but the talent that had created it was beyond doubt. The horse had a joie de vivre that made the smile the punchline of a cheerful joke. You could put a dozen art students in a room, tell them to execute a happy horse, and I was willing to bet not one of them would be able to match the success of that picture. Even the oversized carrot felt not like a mistake, but part of the giggle, an intensifier, an artistic steroid. It's not a joke, I muttered, bending closer. Only bending closer did no good. I was seeing this picture through four aggravating levels of obfuscation. The photograph, the newspaper reproduction of the photograph, the Xerox of the newspaper reproduction of the photograph, and time itself. Over 80 years of it, if I had the math right. What's not a joke? Wireman asked. The way the size of the horse is exaggerated, and the carrot, even the sun rays. It's a child's cry of glee, Wireman. A hoax is what it is, got to be. She would have been two. A child of two can't even make stick figures and call them Mommy and Daddy, can she? Was what happened to Candy Brown a hoax? Or what about the bullet that used to be in your brain? The one that's now gone. He was silent. I tapped child prodigy. Look, they even had the right fancy term for it. Do you suppose if she'd been poor and black, they would have called her Pickaninny Freak and stuck her in a sideshow somewhere? Because I sort of do. If she'd been poor and black, she never would have made the paper at all. Or fallen out of a pony trap to begin with. Is that what happened? I stopped, my eye caught by the blurry photograph again. Now it was Big Sis I was looking at, Adriana. What? Wireman asked, and his tone was, what now? Her bathing suit. Look familiar to you? I can't see very much, just the top. Elizabeth's holding her picture out in front of the rest. What about the part you can't see? He looked for a long time. Wish I had a magnifying glass. That would probably make it worse instead of better. All right, muchacho, it does look vaguely familiar, but maybe that's just an idea you put in my head. In all the girl and ship paintings, there was only one rowboat girl I was never sure of, the one in number 6, the one with the orangey hair, the one in the blue singlet with the yellow stripe around the neck. I tapped Adriana's blurred image in the photocopy Mary Iyer had given me. This is the girl. This is the swimming suit. I'm sure of it. So was Elizabeth. What are we saying here? Wireman asked. He was skimming the print, rubbing at his temples as he did so. I asked if his eye was bothering him. No, this is just so... so fucking... He looked up at me, eyes big, still rubbing his temples. She fell out of that goddamn pony trap and hit her head on a rock, or so it says here. Woke up in the doctor's infirmary just as they were getting ready to transport her to the hospital in St. Pete. Seizures thereafter. It says the seizures continue for baby Elizabeth, although they are moderating and seem to do her no lasting harm. And she started painting pictures. I said, the accident must have happened right after the big group portrait was taken, because she looks exactly the same, and they change fast at that age. Wireman seemed not to notice. We're all in the same rowboat, he said. I started to ask him what he meant, then realized I didn't have to. Si, senor, I said. She fell on her head. I shot myself in the head. You got your head crushed by a payloader. Crane. He waved his hand as if to indicate this made no difference. Then he used the hand to grip my surviving wrist. His fingers were cold. I have questions, muchacho. How come she stopped painting? And how come I never started? I can't say for certain why she stopped. Maybe she forgot, blocked it out, or maybe she deliberately lied and denied. As for you, your talent's empathy. And on Duma Key, empathy got raised to telepathy. That's bullshit. He trailed off. I waited. No, he said. No, it's not. But it's also completely gone. You want to know something, amigo? Sure. He cocked a thumb at the tense family group across the room from us. They had gone back to their discussion. Pop was now shaking his finger at Mom, or maybe it was Sis. A couple months ago, I could have told you what that hoop-de-do was about. Now all I could do is make an educated guess. And probably come out in much the same place, I said. Would you trade one for the other in any case? Your eyesight for the occasional thought wave? God, no, he said, then looked around the calf with an ironic, despairing, head-cocked smile. I can't believe we're having this discussion, you know. I keep thinking I'll wake up and it'll all be as you were, Private Wireman. Assume the position. I looked him in the eye. Ain't gonna happen. 10. According to the Weekly Echo, Baby Elizabeth, as she was referred to almost throughout, began her artistic endeavors on the very first day of her at-home convalescence. She quickly went on, gaining skill and prowess with each passing hour, it seemed to her amazed father. She started with colored pencils. Sound familiar? Wireman asked. Before progressing to a box of watercolors the bemused John Eastlake brought home from Venice. In the 3 months following her accident, much of it spent in bed, she had done literally hundreds of watercolors, turning them out at a rate John Eastlake and the other girls found a little frightening. If Nan Melda had an opinion, it wasn't offered in print. Eastlake tried to slow her down on doctor's orders, but this was counterproductive. It caused fretfulness, crying fits, insomnia, bouts of fever. Baby Elizabeth said when she couldn't draw or paint, her head hurted. Her father said that when she did paint, she ate like one of the horses she liked to draw. The article's author, one M. Rickert, seemed to find this endearing. Recalling my own eating binges, I found it all too familiar. I was going over the muddy print for the third time, with Wireman where my right arm would have been, if I'd had a right arm, when the door opened and Gene Hadlock came in. He was still wearing the black tie and bright pink shirt he'd had on at the show, although the tie had been pulled down and the collar was loosened. He was still wearing green scrub pants and green booties over his shoes. His head was down. When he looked up, I saw a face that was as long and sad as an old bloodhound's. 11:19, he said. There was never really a chance. Wireman put his face in his hands. 11. I got to the Ritz at 12:45 in the morning, limping with fatigue and not wanting to be there. I wanted to be in my bedroom at Big Pink. I wanted to lie in the middle of my bed, push the strange new doll to the floor as I had the ornamental pillows, and hug Reba to me. I wanted to lie there and look at the turning fan. Most of all, I wanted to listen to the whispered conversation of the shells under the house as I drifted off to sleep. Instead, I had this lobby to deal with, too ornate, too full of people and music, cocktail piano, even at this hour. Most of all, too bright. Still, my family was here. I had missed the celebratory dinner. I would not miss the celebratory breakfast. I asked the clerk for my key. He gave it to me, along with a stack of messages. I opened them one after another. Most were congratulations. The one from Ilsa was different. It read, "Are you okay? If I don't see you by 8 a.m., I'm coming to find you. Fair warning." At the very bottom was one from Pam. The note itself was only 4 words long. "I know she died." Everything else that needed saying was expressed by the enclosure. It was her room key. 12. I stood outside 8:47, 5 minutes later, with the key in my hand. I'd moved it toward the slot, then moved my finger toward the doorbell, then looked back toward the elevators. I must have stood that way for 5 minutes or more, too exhausted to make up my mind, and might have stood there even longer if I hadn't heard the elevator doors open, followed by the sound of tipsy, convivial laughter. I was afraid it would turn out to be someone I knew, Tom and Bosie, or Big Ange and his wife, maybe even Lynn and Rick. In the end, I hadn't booked the entire floor, but I'd taken most of it. I pushed the key into the lock. It was the electronic kind you didn't even have to turn. A green light came on, and as the laughter from down the hall came closer, I slipped inside. I had ordered her a suite, and the living room was big. There had apparently been a before-show party because there were two room service tables and lots of plates with remains of canapés on them. I spotted three champagne buckets. Two of the bottles were sticking bottoms up, dead soldiers. The third appeared to still be alive, although on life support. That made me think of Elizabeth again. I saw her sitting beside her China village, looking like Katharine Hepburn in Woman of the Year, saying, "See how I put the children outside the schoolhouse. Do come see." Pain is the biggest power of love. That's what Wireman says. I threaded my way around chairs where my nearest and dearest had sat, talking and laughing, and I was sure of it, toasting my hard work and good fortune. I took the last champagne bottle from the pool in which it sat, held it up to the wall-length picture window showcasing Sarasota Bay, and said, "Here's to you, Elizabeth. Hasta la vista, mi amada." What does amada mean? I turned. Pam was standing in the bedroom doorway. She was wearing a blue nightgown. I didn't remember. Her hair was down. It hadn't been so long since Ilsa was in junior high school. It touched her shoulders. "It means darling," I said. "I learned it from Wireman. He was married to a Mexican woman."
"Was?"
"She died."
"Who told you about Elizabeth?"
"The young man who works for you. I asked him to call if there was news. I'm so sorry." I smiled. I tried to put the champagne bottle back and missed the bucket. Hell, I missed the table. The bottle hit the carpet and rolled. Once the daughter of the godfather had been a child, holding out her picture of a smiling horse for a photographer's camera. The photographer probably some jazzy guy wearing a straw hat and arm garters. Then she had been an old woman jittering away the last of her life in a wheelchair while her snood came loose and flailed from one final hairpin under the fluorescent lights of an art gallery office. And the time between? It probably seemed like no more than a nod or the wave of a hand to the clear blue sky. In the end, we all go smashed to the floor. Pam held out her arms. There was a full moon shining in through the big window, and by its light I could see the rose tattoo on the swell of her breast. Something else new and different. But the breast was familiar. I knew it well. "Come here," she said. I came. I struck one of the room service tables with my bad hip, gave a muttering cry, and stumbled the last 2 steps into her arms, thinking this was a nice reunion. We were both going to land on the carpet, me on top of her. Maybe I could even break a couple of her ribs. It was certainly possible. I'd put on 20 pounds since coming to Duma Key. But she was strong. I forgot that. She held my weight, at first bracing against the side of the bedroom door, then standing up straight with me in her arms. I put my own arm around her and laid my cheek on her shoulder, just breathing in the scent of her. Wireman. I woke up early and I've been having such a wonderful time with my chinas. Come on, Eddie, you're tired. Come to bed. She led me into the bedroom. The window in here was smaller, the moonlight thinner, but the window was open and I could hear the constant sigh of the water. Are you sure? Hush. I'm sure I've been told your name, but it escapes me. So much does now. I never meant to hurt you. I'm so sorry. She put two fingers against my lips. I don't want you sorry. We sat side by side on the bed in the shadows. What do you want? She showed me with a kiss. Her breath was warm and tasted of champagne. For a little while, I forgot about Elizabeth and Wireman, picnic baskets, and Du McKee. For a little while, there was just she and I, like the old days, the two-arm days. For a little while after that, I slept, until the first light came creeping. The loss of memory isn't always the problem. Sometimes, maybe even often, it's the solution.